Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no, how would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics Podcast in the Times. I'm Matt Chorley. A looming general election, a party on the verge of an historic landslide, a leader with an iron-like grip on message discipline, waging war on complacency. Sound familiar?
A new dawn has broken, has it not?
Education, education, and education.
Tough on crime and tough on the causes of crime.
A politics of courage and honesty and trust.
Welcome to Lessons in a Landslide, an exclusive Red Box podcast series to mark 20 years since New Labour swept to power. In interviews with all of the key players in the 1997 campaign, recorded before Theresa May triggered her snap election, we discuss life on the political front line and the behind-the-scenes battles between Labour's big beasts. In this episode, I speak to Alistair Campbell, the former journalist hired almost against his will by Tony Blair to be his director of communications. New Labour's attack dog describes how he waged a war against complacency even after the polls closed, insists that being cuddlier with journalists wouldn't have delivered the same result, and describes why Jeremy Corbyn is not even as impressive as Michael Foote.
I mean, there's Peter Snow saying possible majority of 171.
Well, I would doubt that, but I think it's fair to say we've had a very good campaign and we're having a very good night.
Well, I mean, 171 is...
Looking back now, 20 years on, do you remember it any more fondly?
No, not really. I still feel slightly let down that I didn't enjoy it. No, I don't know why I didn't enjoy it. I think it was a mixture of things. I was probably exhausted. And the worst thing for me, and I think Tony felt this a bit as well, is that most of the people who were there just as part of the crowd, they were that was it. They'd done what they were doing, whether they were party workers or whatever. But, you know, there was no stopping because it's something extraordinary about our system that, so we, you know, he wins in Sedgefield, get the count, get on the plane, fly down, do all that festival hall stuff and then get a bit of sleep and then he's off and he's the Prime Minister and he's off to see the Queen and it just didn't stop. So, no, I remember... I mean, I don't really feel the need to think of it in terms of fondly or not fondly. It was just like at the time, it was the culmination, as you said in your introduction, of 3 years flat-out work. And maybe that's why I didn't enjoy it, because it was, you know, just sort of... I don't know. But and also the fact I probably was depressed at the time, just sort of, you know, looking back, for whatever reason. I think that was a mixture of exhaustion And also the scale of it, you know, you sort of think, oh my God, you know, what have we done? It's like I remember at the count when we were watching the television at one point, and these seats were falling that we hadn't even campaigned in. And I remember Tony saying, you know, what on earth is going on? And it's like, so yeah, it was a big thing, but I didn't feel that joy that everybody else seemed to be feeling.
So if we rewind
back a bit, back to the summer of 1994, and at the time you were political editor of the Today newspaper. Labour supporting, but you know, a successful political journalist, and lots of people thought that that's where your career was going. But then Blair comes to you, and he had a bit of a job to persuade you even to take the job, didn't he?
He did, although I think deep down I probably was always going to do it, but I certainly was putting up all the obstacles.
Yeah.
I was telling him all the reasons why I thought it was a bad idea. And also at home it was difficult because, you know, Fiona, my partner, didn't want to do it. We just had our third child. It was tricky. And all my friends and family were saying, don't do it, you're crazy. And Neil Kinnock very violently saying, you know, I mean violently in language terms, saying, don't do it, this is going to completely destroy your life. But I think that I'd maybe reached that point in my life of thinking, as you say, I was an avowedly pro-Labour journalist, both at the Mirror and at Today. And I'd reached that point in saying to myself, look, you know, you probably can make a bit of difference on the margins of politics as a journalist, but actually if you want to really kind of get stuck in and make change, you've got to do it. And also I think there was something about Tony that made me want to do it, because I sensed there was something big going to go on, you know. So I said no a few times, and then I said I'd take a month to think about it. Fiona and I went off with the kids on holiday. Tony pitched up with Cherie and the kids and the mother-in-law, and he sort of persuaded me, really, and that was it.
How, because obviously now people look back and it was such a massive landslide that, you know, that by 97 it seemed inevitable, but in 94, how confident were you about him becoming Prime Minister? Were you getting there? Did it feel like a risk, or was it more of a sort of the personal risk of the impact it would have on you?
Throughout, we, both of us, and also other people who were involved, this whole thing about, you know, war on complacency, it was real, and I saw it as, I think, part of my job to think we could lose every day. And so I did think we could lose.
And
you know, clearly there was a feeling that the Tory government was, you know, had a lot of problems, the things weren't going great, but at the same time you always felt, I've never underestimated the Conservatives as a kind of fighting machine, and I always felt they could come back. You know, you mentioned the diaries. If you read the diaries, there's a sense almost that all the time we're thinking this can slip away.
Well, even on the morning when the results are coming in, you went out and spoke to some journalists outside, and would say in your diaries, even then you were sort of talking
They thought I was mad. I mean, it's you know, it's really strange that as well. But even after the count, and I think Tony was feeling something similar, because we'd agreed to do this interview with John Simpson. Tony would do this interview with John Simpson, and we got to the count, and Tony said, you know, I just can't be bothered. And so I did it, and I was, I actually saw it a few years ago. It was on one of those programmes that there was sort of about the election. I mean, you'd have thought my mother had just died. I was just sort of like, you know, so John was kind of trying to get me to be all kind of up, and then I was saying, well, let's just see how it goes, early days. You know what normally people do when they know they're losing. I was doing it, and you would win.
Was that the impact, do you think, of the 92 election? The Labour Party being scarred by getting too overexcited?
Partly that. I think also, I think part of our mindset that made us so obsessive and obsessed about winning was the fact that we were, your word, scarred, but also I really think you mustn't take anything for granted in campaigns. Things do happen, stuff does go wrong, and I think it's only if you have that mindset that you can stop a lot of things going wrong that otherwise might. And I definitely saw that as part of my kind of my job and my role, and you know, I was with most of the team most of the time I tried to be upbeat, but at other times I think it is part of your job to say, listen, stop being relaxed, stop being complacent. And you've got to do everything. That's why when I look at the Labour Party today, and they say, yeah, we can win, and the next question is always, well, what are you doing to make that happen? And what are you not doing to make that happen? And we used to have that mindset all the time, and I think it's an important part of how we won.
Do you think being a journalist first, rather than a sort of career politician or a sort of policy wonk, that you knew how, you know, you don't see it as a journalist all the time, how stories turn really quickly and somebody's up and somebody's down. Did you bring that?
Maybe, but I think most politicians get that as well. Yeah. I think if you've been around Westminster, most politicians are aware of how that goes. I remember when Tony asked me to do the job, he said tactical minds are two a penny, but he wanted strategic minds, people who could think about, you know, how to make big things happen, how to stay resilient, how to stay the course, and how to build big arguments. And I think that's what we did. But yeah, look, I think me having been the journalist that I had been, I think it cut both ways as well. I mean, I think I'd made quite a lot of enemies as a journalist. You know, I wrote a piece for the New Statesman once about a foreign trip, and there were some journalists who never spoke to me again because they thought it was kind of, you know, just. It was when Neil Kinnock went to see Reagan, and I wrote this. I remember the headline was "You guys are the Pits." So I'd made enemies in the press as well as, you know, but. So I think the being a journalist thing was helpful up to a point, but I think it cut both ways.
One of the things I want to ask about was the name New Labour, and I think Tony credits you in his book for coming up with New Labour, New Britain. But even then, he talks about how there were rows about whether or not the N should have been a capital or not, and how big a impact. And now it just seems completely taken for granted, and new doesn't seem like, you know, that big a deal. But all the time you seem to be fighting what now look like quite small battles, but I suppose they end up being part of a bigger battle to change the party.
Well, I think often when you make change, I think some, you know, quite often it's the fear of what might happen when you do it. And there was a lot of resistance. You know, the first conference when Tony stood up and made the speech talking about, you know, we were going to change clause 4, but we didn't actually say it.
Yeah.
It was all very. I can remember, I think it was George Robertson who said, you know, people stood in for this standing ovation, and as they were standing there, you could hear the sound of pennies dropping all around the hall. And, you know, managing that and bringing John Prescott on board, because John was instinctively very against. I can remember Robin Cook, the morning of the speech, Robin Cook saying to Tony, you know, this could sort of destroy you before you start. I remember Peter Mandelson and I, Tony asking us what we thought the odds were that actually this might destroy him. I mean, it was a real fear at the time. And I think sometimes with change, it's only when it's happened that, as you say, you look back and you think, well, why was that such a big deal? But at the time, it was a big deal.
Yeah. And what was it like managing those personalities? Because there were so many big personalities.
I saw Rory Bremner the other day, and he was saying that, you know, he's finding it's almost like he's out of a job now. He felt he had a lot of big personalities during that period. It's like, you know, he said even Philip Hammond doesn't do Philip Hammond. But I think, that was a big part of the job for sure. And I think another of the reasons why Tony wanted me there was because I wasn't a politician, as you say. I wasn't an MP. But I knew these people very, very well. And also, you've got to remember, I mean, the weird thing about when I first met Tony, when he was first elected as an MP, I mean, at that time, you know, within the sort of Labour Party firmament, newly elected MP that nobody's ever heard of, and political editor of the Daily Mirror, the only Labour-supporting newspaper, it's sort of, so I had a role, and I had a relationship, and I think they all knew. I mean, John Prescott, for example, when Tony asked me to do the job, I said, well, I want John Prescott to be on board for this, because John and I had some really big bust-ups down the years. I think I did become the kind of, in fact, I was with John last weekend up at the whole Burnley game, I think I did become a kind of Tony's main point man for John, who, you know, there was a certain sort of Labour Party, new Labour person that John just didn't like and wouldn't deal with.
Is that sort of Peter Mandelson?
Well, I used to take personal offence at this, because he used to refer them to as the beautiful people, you know, and I like to consider myself as one of the more handsome sort of. It was anything to do with polling and anything to do with, I don't know, he just had a thing about, you know, the Andrew Adonis, like he used to call him the Mekon, and it's like all these policy wonks. So that had to be managed, you know, because and then there was, you know, the whole thing with Gordon was, there were some periods when it was easy and other periods when it wasn't.
Was that overall, do you think, an advantage or a hindrance to the Labour Party and New Labour, having such big personalities and playing out these conflicts and you having to make your case and it wasn't all
well,
being ruled by one person?
They are two separate but related questions. Was it an advantage to have lots of big personalities? Definitely. was it an advantage to be having all these differences of, which often weren't about policy, sometimes they were, but often they weren't.
About ego?
I think a lot of it was about ego and ambition, yeah. And about status and about people's, I mean, you know, to be fair to Tony, I don't think he was that status conscious. I don't think he is now.
But then he could afford not to be because he was the leader.
I guess so, but also I think it's a mindset. I think you get a lot of people who get to the top and they are incredibly status conscious. Yeah. You know, you have to be treated in a certain way. You look at the way Trump's behaving now, or I can remember sometimes with, you know, whenever you were with President Chirac, you were very conscious of the fact this guy was the president and he saw himself as such and he expected to be treated as such. Whereas I don't think Tony was like that. And a lot of meetings, a lot of rounds that we had, they were actually about, you know, who was at the meeting, who wasn't at the meeting, who saw the paper, who didn't see the paper.
And rather than what was in the paper, what the meeting
rather
was
than what's this about, and where is this going, does it fit with an overall an overall strategy? And that was just balls aching, to be honest.
I think it was in one of your diaries, you talked about being the nexus of some of the key political and personal relationships which shaped New Labour, and therefore recent British political history. But one of the key things you also, you were managing the relationship with the media as well, and getting the media on side was a massive issue given how hostile the media had been, particularly in 92. How big a challenge was that? How did you sort of approach that? To have gone from, you know, can the last person leave Britain to turn the light, you know, if Neil Kinnock wins, turn the lights out, to having the Sun backing Labour?
I think of itself, was it that important? I think I say in my diary that it's ridiculous in a way that it's seen as important, but it is.
But I
think we, maybe Tony and I had slightly different views on this. I think Tony wanted to have as good relationships as possible with as many people within the media as possible when we were in opposition, because, you know, if they do sort of collectively decide they're going to try and kill you, then I'm not saying they can. But they make your life much, much more difficult.
Yeah.
And if you're not careful, you spend all your time on the back foot. What it was about for us always was about the public. So, yes, we had strategies to try to get the Sun on board. Not sort of in terms of getting them to back us, but certainly trying to sort of, you know, remove the claws, and stop the really nasty stuff. And we had the same for the Mail. I mean, it was only about 2000 that we sort of gave up on the Mail and just realised it had become a total kind of anti-Blair, anti-New Labour propaganda sheet. But generally, I think the most important thing that we tried to do, even though you were having to manage the media as you went, was actually to settle these core strategic positions.
Yeah.
And if you got those right, it's very difficult for... I can remember once at a conference, I can't remember which conference it was, it might even have been the first one, but I can remember David English when he was editor of the Mail, and I just coincidentally happened to be, he was watching the speech from the back of the hall and I was just sort of hanging around watching Tony do the speech, and I can just remember him sort of infusing in a way that made me think, yeah, it's going to be hard for him just to sort of keep putting the boot in for the sake of it. And that was about the reality of what Tony was saying. He just thought, this is a really attractive leader saying something new, something interesting, something that's going to chime with a lot of people. And it's like the Sun, I mean, I think the Sun liked to think, and the media likes to think, that they kind of swing elections. And I'm not saying they're not influential. They're influential in how you frame the debate. But I think ultimately the Sun backed us because they knew we were going to win.
Yeah.
I don't think we won because they backed us.
And also, if you're trying to build a broad base of support across large social demographic
groups,
you need the sort of people who read the most read newspapers.
Absolutely. And also it's almost symbolic if you're... You know, if you're sort of saying you want, there's no part of the country that you see as off limits, there's no part of the political spectrum that you don't think should be at least thinking about voting for the Labour Party, then you've got to get your message out to them. And sometimes actually doing things with a certain media outlet might be the best way of signalling that. I mean, we've got, you know, one of the most difficult relationships in a way was managing the Mirror, which, you know, rightly saw itself as a paper that I, you know, ought to be very loyal to because I'd worked for it for so long, and also because it had always been supportive of the Labour Party. And they got really hacked off that they felt often we were, you know, leaning overboard to try and get these right-wing papers
They've been there in the difficult times, and now you're taking them for granted.
And managing that was very, very difficult at times. But, you know, and likewise, and, you know, if you remember, we got a lot of flack for some of the TV stuff we did, you know, going on Richard and Judy, doing an interview with Des O'Connor.
But Des O'Connor was one of the ones I was going to ask about, because looking back through that campaign, it was striking for me how much TV and, you know, even how many TV interviews there were on the 9 o'clock news and stuff like that. It was just don't happen anymore.
Yeah.
But doing things like Des O'Connor, that was a massive change from the sort of thing that people did before.
Well, I think it was certainly a change, and it was and it was a risk as well, because and it's really strange. I think I say in the book that Tony was so nervous about that. I mean, compared to doing Jeremy Paxman or, you know, BBC, John Humphreys, whatever, he was really nervous about it because it was out of his political comfort zone. And he you know, right up to the point of sort of at certain points in the build-up saying, I don't want to do that. Why am I doing this? I don't want to do this. And actually he did, I think I say in the diaries that some weeks after the Des O'Connor thing, he said, I think I owe you an apology, because what was happening was that we were travelling around the country and people who would never listen to the Today programme, never watch Newsnight.
Normal people.
Well, essentially. No, I'm not saying a lot of normal people.
The people outside this bubble that we operate in.
And they were coming up and saying, oh, I saw you on the Des O'Connor show. Oh, you were terrific on Des O'Connor. Yeah. No. And no, that may not have shifted a vote, but it might have cemented an opinion about it. So those sorts of, and I think sometimes just doing things differently that looked a bit fresh, that felt a bit new, that felt a bit different. I think that, you know, they I'm not saying they swung the election, they didn't, but the fact that Tony could take his message to anyone, to anywhere, was an important part of what we were trying to say.
It's interesting how the 97 campaign became seen as the sort of template of how you run a campaign. The sort of, just the way it looks, the daily, you know, certainly the way you did daily press conferences. You had celebrities, whether it was Helen Mirren one day or whoever. And George Osborne and David Cameron would say that they looked to the sort of new Labour model for how they were doing it. But presumably you didn't feel then like you were redefining the way your campaigns were done. It was just...
No, not at all. And I felt we were working. I felt we had a sense of strategy. I always felt that. I felt we were innovative. If I look at the way campaign has changed so much even since then, even in the three campaigns that we did, you know, it's changed so much. But I think we brought a professionalism and a discipline to our campaigns that I think the Tories felt was their monopoly.
Yeah.
So actually, a lot of the stuff we did, I think they'd been trying to do for quite a long time and been quite successful at messaging and at centralisation and coordination. But I think we brought systems to it that certainly helped. And we had some great people, you know, we had really good, innovative people. And, you know, even tiny things now, you look back and you think, well, it's so obvious. But I can remember one of the advertising guys just saying, look, it'll cost you next to nothing. Why don't you just book for 1 hour that thing up at the rotating thing up at Piccadilly Circus
and put a physical message
up? Yeah. And it got huge sort of coverage on the television and the newspapers. And so it was like, now that's just a tiny kind of innovative thing, but we had a lot of people who were thinking and they were encouraged to think, let's try and do things a bit differently. You know, again, read the diaries. I mean, it was a struggle a lot of the time to get people to do the basics. So, no, I didn't feel at the time that we were doing something amazing and groundbreaking. I just felt it was very hard work, and we were working hard. That's what I felt.
The thing that comes across a lot is how tired everyone was.
Yeah.
And just what a slog it seems, sort of counting down each day.
It is, and you know what? When you look at these American campaigns, and, you know, I know why they have to do them, because it's a bigger country, and, you know, the system was devised pre-television, pre-air travel and all that, but, you know, a general election campaign of a few weeks when you're on the road and when you're dealing with all the stuff you've got to deal with 24 hours a day, with the media coming at you from every angle, it is utterly exhausting. Yeah, I think that does come through, but that's when you need people who are able to just to deliver and organise. And, the same people tend to get mentioned in terms of, you know, what made the campaign work. But a lot of what made the campaign work were people on the end of a phone at an office, you know, who, when you phoned them and said, listen, we need this done quickly, they would do it. So I think we had a really good organisation at every level.
The sort of Millbank Tower became this sort of byword for the slick, ultra-professionalised media operation which New Labour had, which the Tories just didn't have. But then, as with all these things, that then becomes a sort of, it ends up becoming a pejorative and it was over-controlling and over, you know. At what point did you think that happened? Did you Did you think you ever were over-controlling, or was that just a price you had to pay for
I don't think I was ever over-controlling. I think that clearly I was over-controlling some people. But no, I think, and even you know, I didn't care about what the media said about the campaign. I mean, all I cared about was whether the campaign was effective or not. And it was important as well to have Tony's support in that. I remember much later, once we were in government, I can remember, you know, when I used to get... I remember there was a point when somebody did an analysis saying, this is when Duncan Smith was the leader, saying that I was getting more media exposure than Duncan Smith. It was absurd. And I can remember thinking, this is a bit of a problem. But I remember Tony saying, listen, as long as we both keep understanding why they're doing this to try and make you less effective because they want to bring me down. And he always had that sense. So the whole thing about control, he never really worried about whether the campaign was being slagged off or whether we were being defined negatively. As long as
the campaign was working.
As long as it was effective, yeah.
Do you look back at the way that you behaved and think you took it up, not that you took it too seriously, because obviously it was serious, but there were moments when you lost it, when maybe you shouldn't have done?
No, not really. There might have been the odd moment. There's a couple of moments, I think, of times when I lost my rag with people, journalists. You see, it is serious in the end, isn't it? It is serious. You're trying to, you know, you're trying to replace a government. And you think you've worked out a strategy to do that. You're trying to build a team to do that. You're trying to do all the stuff that you need to do that. And maybe, but I by and large, you see, I can only operate that way. I can't operate without being full on.
Yeah.
Would it have been more effective? So that's the question I asked, would it be more effective or less effective if I'd have been a bit cuddlier? I'd think it'd have been less effective.
Because it was about control.
It was about waking up every morning and saying to yourself, what do we need to do today to make this happen? And how do we stop happening the things that will damage us as we go? And that was it.
What impact did technology have? And particularly then some of the later campaigns as well. Because I was struck reading, as you talked about flying from Sedgefield down to London, you were getting the results here on a pager in the plane. And Tony said to you, is that going to, you know, bring the plane down? But the way that Tony, you know, the obsession with newspapers now compared, you know, back then compared to now, would be, you know, what's happening online or on rolling news or social media and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, it's changed. It's definitely changed. But I don't think the fundamentals of campaign have changed. I still think you have to have, for a big campaign, you have to have a clear strategy, you have to have a good leader, you have to have a good team, you have to be inventive and innovative about how you communicate and how you get your message across, you have to work hard. Those things haven't changed. I think that, you know, I keep reading the role that data and technology played in Brexit, played in Trump, and maybe there's stuff going on there that, you know, so far ahead of what we knew and what we did, I don't know. But I still think that the basics of a campaign, there are certain basics you have to do that are still there. You still need that leader, you still need that strategy and that vision, you still need people who are going to work their balls off to, you know, to deliver.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
To what extent do you think that the rise of Trump and Brexit that we've seen in the UK is a reaction to the over-controlling, London-centric, centralised politics that probably started with New Labour?
Well, people used to say the same about Thatcher, didn't they? They used to say Thatcher was, you know, domineering and...
Particularly the sort of the style of campaign... Because actually, the referendum campaign, the Remain campaign, was very New Labour-ish. They had all the celebrities, they had all the business leaders, they had all their photo ops, and it just didn't seem to strike a chord.
Well, listen, we could have a long conversation about what I thought of weaknesses in the campaign, but look, I think it's a reaction to a lot of things, and I don't doubt that for some people it's a feeling that I don't think it's about the controlling thing. I think it's. I really believe that Trump and Brexit are about the global financial crisis and people's response to that, yeah. And the feeling that people who caused it have got away with it. And they both, Brexit and Trump, have been able to capitalise on it ridiculously in many ways, but they have. So I don't see it. I think, you know, a New Labour having been the party of power for a decade, clearly that's a big factor within that in Britain, but I don't see that as an overriding.
No.
And I certainly don't think it's about control. I think that, I think you mentioned earlier the concept of the bubble. I think outside the bubble, people don't sit there thinking about, you know, the way the media is managed, and they might do a little bit at the margins, but I think there's very much for, you know, for here we are in Milbank, for here, you know, I don't really see that as a much of an outside argument. That being said, I think we did underestimate the extent to which the whole focus on our communications would become such an issue. But I think that part of me felt that was because the Conservatives and the media felt they couldn't get us on policy and strategy, so they went for the kind of presentational stuff.
And so looking back, let's go back to where we started 20 years ago. What's your sort of highlight? What's the bit of the campaign or the moment in 97 that you remember most fondly? Or was it just a hard, miserable slog?
It was a grind. I mean, I'll tell you the moment when you say that, the moment that sort of stands out for me, maybe we're back to my depressive personality here, was actually phoning home the night before and my son Callum saying to me, and he would have been, what would he have been, 10? And him saying to me, are we going to win? And I don't know why, but it just put the phone down, it made me cry. And it was like, and that was the moment when, yeah, I felt we've won.
Yeah.
I felt there's no way this can go wrong now. And it wasn't that made me think that, but that was the moment when I finally let go of this notion that we might lose. So that was very, very memorable. And then I think, you know, notwithstanding that I was not very chirpy at Festival Hall, by the time we got to Downing Street, I'd kind of rediscovered my mojo a bit. I can remember when we went to the... Because Jonathan Powell and I went in the two car... The police were behind Tony, and then Jonathan and I were in the car behind. And we went... I can't remember even why, but we went to the palace with them. And again, it was partly to do with family. We got upstairs and we were talking to Robin Jandrin, who was the Queen's private secretary, while Tony was in, yeah, seeing the Queen. And the TV was on in the background, and Robin was looking over my shoulder, and he said, "Oh, look at the lovely children in Downing Street." And I turned around, and there was my daughter, my son, sitting on the steps of number 10. And it was like, it was weird. I remember phoning my mum and I said, "Are you watching this?" "Of course I'm watching it." And so that was a kind of... But no, the overriding memories are of waking up at 5 in the morning in, you know, not great hotels often, and getting on a bus and ticking off dozens of events and interviews and what have you, and then getting there and I do look back, you know, I do look back. A lot of it's about the because I spent most of my time with Tony. There was a big argument going on the whole time whether I should be in Milbank, whether I should be on the road, and I ended up doing a bit of both, but mainly on the road with Tony. And but there was just this sense when we'd won of that we'd really built a great team. Mm. And that was so, you know, as I'm talking to you now, I'm sort of all sorts of people coming, yeah, to my head that you would never have heard of, you know, who were just a big part of what, yeah, we did.
And then, like you said, unlike in the American system where they have 3 or 4 months to get ready, after all of that you still have to walk up Downing Street and you, yeah, go in and the work starts immediately.
I remember there was a little bit of kind of relaxation is the wrong word, but there was a lunch and Tony's dad was there and his kids were there, and but yeah, he had to, you know, appoint a cabinet. I did my first number 10 briefing, and yeah, it was just straight off, and you're completely exhausted. It's a ridiculous way to work.
And particularly, it's telling lots of people's accounts of it, is the partly the amount of time that's taken up by campaigning, but also not wanting to be seen to be taking things for granted and measuring the curtains and all that. There's a sort of deliberate decision not to prepare too much because you don't want to look like you're being presumptuous.
Well,
and that then becomes a well,
I can remember during the build-up when Robin Butler was the cabinet secretary, yeah, and he did a briefing for some of the press about you know what happened in the civil service as they prepared for possible different outcomes.
Yeah,
perfectly reasonable thing to do, I guess. But needless to say,
you didn't see it like that at the time.
I didn't like to see it like that because I knew how the press would take that. They'd take this as the civil service getting ready for Labour.
Yeah,
and that, however that gets presented, it looks like almost like it's now being taken for granted.
Yeah,
and so I just said, look, you know, and we I can't remember. I think I said something publicly about you know that it wasn't exactly very helpful. But meanwhile, Jonathan Powell was actually fairly steadily talking through what might happen,
yeah,
who would go where, which people would come from the campaign into number 10 and all that sort of stuff. But I was adamant that I wouldn't get involved in that because I felt that for me, for my sort of mentality and psychology for the campaign, I just did not want to acknowledge that we could win until we had one.
Yeah. And I can't not ask you about 20 years on in the state of the Labour Party now. I mean, it seems a long way off a repeat of a Labour landslide. What do you think is happening? What could happen to the Labour Party to get it back?
Well, I find it very difficult. I've just written 6,000 words on this for GQ, and even at the end of writing it, I'm not entirely sure what we can do. It's difficult. It's very difficult. But you're right. We're a long way from that. I mean, even people who are broadly supportive of Labour and want Labour to do well. I mean, it's very rare that you meet people these days who think we can win. And I think that was a tragedy for the Labour Party, but I also think it's really difficult for the country at a time when Brexit's happening, and I think it's going to be a disaster. And you know, the opposition seem to be manoeuvred into, as far as the public's concerned, has seen it. They're sort of, you know, they've supported them on Article 50 and what have you. So, look, I don't think ultimately. I said earlier that there are certain fundamentals. You have to have a good leader. You have to have a clear strategy. You have to have a great team. You have to have people who are going to, you know, work flat out. Now,
at the moment, Labour Party's failing on all of those, aren't they, really?
We're not doing terribly well, yeah. It's got to be said. And up against the government, I really think if there was an opposition able to keep their feet to the fire, I think they'd be struggling because I don't see much there.
Right.
I do think that the Brexit route that Theresa May has taken is an absolute disgrace because I don't think she has the mandate for it. And yet it's almost like we'll be calmed. I mean, in America, the Trump thing has led to a kind of upsurge in activism and protest and satire and all these things, and it's almost like we're just becalmed. It's like people say, oh well, get on with it. But I think a lot of that is because people aren't seeing where the competitive energy is coming from in politics.
It looks like there is no alternative. You just have to accept, you know, it's like sort of bad.
It feels to me, it's almost like we've got a one, you know, it feels like you've got a one party state in Scotland and a one party state in England. Yeah. And, you know, people keep saying, well, why UKIP having helped to win Brexit, why are they sort of vanishing? And the answer is that the government are basically, you know, people say UKIP light, I'd say they're UKIP pretty heavy.
Yeah.
And so Labour's got to get back on the pitch and in a way that at least, you know, reasonable people start to think there's a chance. Otherwise, our democracy fails.
And there's been talk about another party and the sort of, whether it's Tony or Nick Clegg or George Osborne, or is that a realistic proposition, do you think?
I really don't know. I mean, I don't know, but I do think that our politics as they are feel very hard to sustain. In the, I mean, if you go back to the, people keep comparing it to the 80s, and I think that actually if you think back to then, Michael Foot, I mean, okay, he got done over with that whole nonsense about his so-called donkey jacket and all the rest of it. But Michael Foot was a great orator, extraordinary writer, and a towering intellect. He had experience of government. And then there's all this talk now, you know, about the new SDP, blah, 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 blah. The people who went off and sorted the SDP, they were giants compared to a lot of what we have now in our politics. And I think there's a, you know, with first past the post, I think it's very, very difficult. But, we appear to be heading towards an election where the choice is going to be this hard Brexit, right-wing Tory party, and a Labour party with a leader who appears to be unassailable pursuing a politics that appears to be unelectable.
Yeah.
for millions and millions of people in Britain. And that means that there is a sense for a lot of people of feeling politically homeless.
So would you get involved in a new party?
No. I mean, I will vote Labour. But at the moment, I just feel we're not facing up to the reality of how bad things are. And every time I say that, you get people on social media saying, you know, if only you'd all just shut up and unite behind Jeremy and blah, blah, blah. But what are we uniting around? Where is the policy platform? Where is that? I talked earlier about all that detailed work you have to do. So I think there's no point getting away from the fact we're in a bit of a mess. Now, what gives within the system? It may be the system that ends up changing, I just don't know. But the Tories aren't going to change the system when it's working as well for them as it is at the moment.
One of the things that Tony wrote in his book was he said, I'm not sure it was great for him. This is talking about you. He said, I'm not sure it was great for him, but it was great for me. Do you think that experience was great for you, or was it?
Yeah, I think. I mean, yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm glad. I always say that if you read the diaries,
They are sort of relentlessly sort of downbeat. And I suppose that's partly what diary, you know, if it's an end of day.
No, I am
end of a tired day reflection on a, you know, you remember the bad stuff.
A lot of people who read my diaries say, how on earth did you manage to keep going for so long when you were clearly kind of. So I often look back and say, I wasn't happy a lot of the time that I was doing it, but I'm very, very happy that I've done it. And, you know, it's true that. I mean, the life that if you'd have said to me when I was a journalist back in the 80s and the early 90s, you know, one day you'll go into Downing Street and you'll sort of work with Bill Clinton and you'll meet Mandela loads of times and you'll help to win three elections and then you'll leave and you'll never do another job again because you'll develop all these different sort of interests and different sort of ways of working and what have you. I said, neither of those things would happen. And yet, I mean, so, you know, it's 14 years since I left Downing Street, and yet I'm still totally defined by it in many ways, even though I've done loads and loads and tons of other stuff. And I don't mind that. I don't mind it at all. And I mean, I sometimes say to my kids that, you know, look, I accept I wasn't around as much as I should have been and what have you, but there's been an upside as well, and I think they get that. But I'm glad I did it. I'm glad I did it. But it was I'd be lying if I said it was a barrel of laughs every day. Although the one thing that I think does come through the diaries, there was within that inner core team, we had there was always a lot of both light and dark humour going on, and you need that.
You definitely need that. Alistair Campbell, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Red Boxes series, Lessons in a Landslide. Subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss future episodes using iTunes on your Android device. And sign up to my morning Red Box email briefing at thetimes.co.uk/redbox. But for now, for me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.